we welcome you to the Studs Terkel Wax Museum, heard on WFMT each weekday from 10 a.m. to 11. And here's Studs.
Well, thank you, Marty. This morning, one way or another, we made it. The continuation of the conversation with Gene Shepherd. Gene Shepherd is a monologist. I think it's pronounced monologist. I used to say monologist as a kid, but there was Julius Tannen, an old vaudeville monologist, a monologist, and he was usually he was originally number two act in vaudeville, which is not a very important one. It follows the acrobats that open the show, but later on he became the number eight act and nine act bill, which was the real headliner. But Gene Shepherd is one, an electronic monologist, that his medium is definitely radio, though he's been a number of plays. And he has his own audience in New York, a rather interesting one, in Greenwich Village. They're called the Night People. He's on late at night, and for years now he's been talking on this one station for an hour, perhaps hour and a half. No guests, and Gene just talks. And most of his talk concerns memories and free association, particularly his boyhood here in Hammond, Indiana, in the Midwest. So he's Midwestern, and he earlier in the program yesterday, Gene was talking about conjecturing as to one of the reasons why he's so popular among so many of the young in New York, the so-called hippies. And one reason is they're sort of not quite certain what it is they've missed, but they've missed something about the past. Not that all of it's been good. Most of it's been terrible. A lot of it's been terrible. But they know there's something, perhaps looking for a kind of continuity. And Midwestern stories, for some reason, seem to attract many of them. Stories of cities or smaller towns, certainly smaller than New York. Well, yesterday, his new book, published by Doubleday, is called In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. And they're really reminiscences, some of which have been on recordings. But this is Gene's own style in writing, and he's talking. And yesterday he was talking about his memories of Little Orphan Annie and decoding the mystery message, which turns out to be an Ovaltine commercial after all, his turning out to be the blind date, memories of the socks. Do we have a word from Marty, and then his prime story in the book in a moment?
You're right, Studs. It's monologist. I looked it up. If you're planning a career in the theater, or if you're interested in theatrical courses for self-improvement, find out about the evening classes beginning January 30th at the Goodman School of Drama. The same fine professionals who teach in the Goodman's famed day school will be offering courses in improvisation, voice control and speech, interpretation and acting. For further information, write to the registrar, Goodman School of Drama, 200 South Columbus Drive, Chicago, or call Central 67080, extension 347. You're wearing the proper headgear this morning for reminiscing, Stutz.
Yes, an old-time cap that is found around the house. I haven't worn headgear as such in 33 years, but the cap. And this brought back a memory, too, since the word monologist has come to mind, and Gene Shepherd is that for radio. I mentioned Julius Tannen. One of the funniest, and here's a strange story. Remember, it was Dr. Rockwell. Dr. Rockwell would come out with the glasses. I think there were glasses without lenses. Perhaps he had them. And he'd bring out a banana stalk. The banana stalk was the human spine. He'd talk about it. And very, very glib, of course, very articulate. And the words would flow out, all nonsense, of course. And Dr. Rockwell was one of the best known of monologists in vaudeville in those days. And only to discover that Dr. Rockwell's son is George Lincoln Rockwell, which is interesting. I think perhaps someday that would be an interview I think I'd like very much to undertake, if possible. Not just a condemnation of the views of a man, but to find out how come, perhaps going back to Dr. Rockwell. Well, here then is Gene Shepherd and his story. Continue. Throughout this book, by the way, there are these memories and these blinding flashes of Gene Shepherd. And it occurs to me, we can't finish this program without one of my favorite stories. There's sequences involving his mother, his father, disputes over one matter, the old time, the movies, the double features, and Screeno and Dish Night, and the events that took place there, and Bank Night. But finally ends with the day shift, and the teacher reading the Decameron, that you stole when she expected some Miss Breifogle, whom you like very much.
Yeah.
But the story of pop art, the beginning, this, to me, this particular sequence, a flick, the bartender pop art, and your experience in the Museum of Modern Art, and your memory of a certain prize your father won, to me, almost symbolizes both the hip, pseudo-hip New York, you know, as against a part of Americana, and somehow it's in this world of pop art. I this particular chap you've got to do.
You like that chapter?
Very much. I think that, to me, is almost the core of the book. It's throughout, there are other parts in it, but that particular one.
Well, you know, I'm really delighted you say that, Studs, because I felt for a long time that that the difference in aesthetic values between the Midwest and the Far East is New York and America is such a fantastic gulf that it is a fit subject for humor and also a serious study.
It is. At the same time, you think of the do you find this, since now you're a veteran New Yorker, in fact, you're inside New York, with a following of many of the kids of Greenwich Village who hear you when you perform, as you do, don't you believe?
I perform every Saturday night down in the village, you know.
Do you feel that they have a certain kind of insecurity, obviously, a certain kind of hunger for something else that you, in a way, represent?
Sure. I think we all do. I don't think that's just limited to New Yorkers. You know, it's funny, you walk around... I found a very interesting thing in America, that every city I go to, no matter where it is, all I have to do is look around. I'm with a native of that town, say. And I say, gee, this is a great town. And he'll look at me and says, yeah, but you don't live here, man. You don't really know how crummy it is. and so that makes me believe that we're all hungry for something else. We're really a hungry, mobile people. That automobile represents a heck of a lot more than a status symbol, and I'll disagree with people who say status symbol. I say it represents an assuagement of that hunger for something else, to go, to be somewhere, to absorb it, to eat it up. And so in New York, I find a fantastic nostalgia and hunger for the non-New York world, for the world where people walk around and scratch and spit and stand around and look at the cornfields. And wherever you go in the cornfield world, they have a hunger for that world of 53rd Street.
Yes. So it's getting away from, it's not only the auto going to, but also getting away from.
Oh, sure, both, getting away from.
I know
from.
This is too long to read in full, this art world. Perhaps you could even tell it. You and Flick are talking.
Flick are talking.
And about... Well, it changed, you know.
And Flick starts out.
It hasn't changed a bit, I'm saying, Flick.
Two truck drivers had taken places at the far end of the bar. Flick ambled down, served them up a pair of Boilermakers. One of them got up immediately, crossed to the jukebox, dropped in a coin, pressed the buttons, and returned to his stool. Immediately, a wavering, reddish-purple light filled the room as the enormous plastic jukebox glowed into vivid neon life. Waterfalls cascaded through its plastic sides. I watched it for a moment, and forgetting where I was, I said, "Pure pop art." Flick paused in his glass polishing.
Pure what?
It was too late to back out. Pop art, Flick. Pure pop art. That jukebox.
What's pop art?
Well, it's hard to explain, Flick. You gotta be with it.
Well, how do you mean? I'm with it.
I sipped my beer to stall for time. Flick, have you ever heard of the Museum of Modern Art in New York?
Yeah. What about it?
Well, Flick...
Now it begins. And now,
that sets the story.
And now you said, if you can summerize the first part here. Now, of course, me and my old man, the lascivious special award.
Well, it starts out, I won't even go into the chapter of how Ralph gets involved in the Museum of Modern Art. There's a satire of the museum world. I wonder how many people here in Chicago realize that the Museum of Modern Art isn't a place where New Yorkers go to look at art. It's a place to go to pick up girls. And a special kind of girl in a special kind of way. Did you know that, man? Oh, sure. You stand in front of any painting in the Museum of Modern Art and you go, uh-huh. And pretty soon a girl behind you will be writing something in a notebook. And then you go, uh-huh. Well, I knew he'd do it. And she says, "Did he?" I'd say, "Yep. Old Klaus finally got one off." And of course, you're talking about Klaus Oldenburg, whom you've never met or anything. But you say, she says, "Do you know him?" You say, "Well." And 20 minutes later, you're in her apartment on 49th Street. And that's the way it's done in New York. However, I recall in this story my father and the first example of pop art I ever saw in my life. My dad was an inveterate joiner of contests. You know these contests you see in the newspapers? Fit the movie stars, puzzle contest, name the presidents, you know, all that. $50,000 first prize, $20,000 second prize, a trip to Hawaii third prize, and other major awards. Well, the old man, every week, he's sitting there at the dining room table and he's filling these things out and sending them into the American, you know, to the Tribune, to the Daily News. Nothing. Nothing ever happened. Until the time they came out with the great heroes in sport. It's the only thing my old man knew anything about. And you want to hear that sequence? All right.
Yeah, that's a beautiful one.
All right.
It's when he sends in and he's one of the finalists, isn't he?
Yeah, he's now made it to the finals. It's unbelievable. He's gotten these letters saying he's in the final.
And there's a letter that comes, he's going to get a very big award.
Yeah. So finally he fills out the last one and we sit and wait. The old man is in the finals and the entire neighborhood has flipped because the word is out, you know, that he's going to win an award and all that. And we sit there and wait, and sure enough, a telegram arrives and it says, "Congratulations. You have won a major award in our $50,000 Great Heroes from the World of Sport contest. It will arrive by special messenger delivered to your address. You are a winner. Congratulations." That night was one of the very few times my father actually got publicly drunk. His cronies whooped and hollered, guzzled and yelled into the early morning hours, knocking over chairs, telling dirty stories. My mother supplied endless sandwiches, constantly mopped up. Harry Gertz, in honor of the occasion, told his famous dirty story about the three bartenders, the Franciscan monk, and the cross-eyed turtle. He told it three times. It was a true victory gala of the purest sort. Early the next morning, the first trickle of a flood of envy-tinged congratulations began to come in. Distant uncles, hazy second cousins, real estate agents, and used car salesmen called to offer heartfelt felicitations and incidental suggestions for highly rewarding investments that they had at their disposal. The old man immediately, once his head had partially cleared, began to lay plans. Perhaps a Spanish adobe-type house in Coral Gables. Or maybe he'd open up his own bowling alley. Victory is heady stuff and has often proved fatal to the victors. The next afternoon, a large, unmarked delivery truck stopped in front of the house. Two workmen unloaded a square, sealed, waist-high cardboard carton, which was lugged into the kitchen. They left and drove off. Somehow, an air of foreboding surrounded their stealthy, unexplained operation. The old man, his face flushed with excitement, fumbled in supercharged haste to lay bare his hard-won symbol of victory. He struggled to open the carton. A billowing mushroom of ground excelsior surged up and out. In he plunged. And there it was. The yellow kitchen light bulb illumined the scene starkly and yet with a touch of glowing promise. Tenderly, he lifted from its nest of fragrant straw the only thing he had ever won in his entire life. We stood silent and in awe at the sheer, shimmering, unexpected beauty of the major award. Before us, in the heavy, fragrant air of our cabbage-scented kitchen, stood a life-size lady's leg in true blushing pink flesh tones and wearing a modiche black patent leather pump with spike heel. When I say life-size, I am referring to a rather large lady who obviously had dined well and had matured nicely. It was a well-filled-out leg. It was so realistic that for a brief instant, we thought that we had received in the mail the work of an artist of the type that was very active at that period, the trunk murderer. For some reason, this spectacular form of self-expression has declined in America, but in those days, something in the air caused many a parson's daughter to hack up her boyfriend into small fragments which were then shipped separately to chosen people at random from the phone book. Upon being apprehended and tried, she was always acquitted, whereupon she accepted numerous offers to appear in vaudeville as a featured headliner, recalling her days as a trunk murderer, complete with props and a dramatized stage version of the deed. For a split instant, it seemed as though our humble family had made the headlines. My mother was the first to recover. "What is it?" "A leg," my father shot incisively back. It was indeed a leg. More of a leg, in fact, than any leg any of us had ever seen. "But what is it?" "Well, it's a leg. Like a statue, I guess." A statue? Our family had never owned a statue. A statue was something always considered to be a lady wearing a wreath and concrete robes, holding aloft a torch in one hand and a book in the other. This was the only kind of statue outside a general sitting on horses that we ever heard about. They all had names like Victory or Peace. If this was a statue, it was the only one that could have had a name, Whoopee. My mother was trying to get herself between the statue and the kids. "Isn't it time for bed?" "Holy smokes, would you look at that?" My father was warming up. "Holy smokes, would you look at that? Do you know what this is?" My mother did not answer, just silently edged herself between my kid brother and the magnificent limb. "Would you believe it? It's a lamp." It was indeed a lamp. A lamp in its own way, a definitive lamp, a masterstroke of the Lightolier's art. It was without question the most magnificent lamp we had ever seen. This was the age of spindly, artificially antiqued, teetery brass contrivances called bridge lamps. These were usually of the school of design known as WPA Neo-Romanticism, a school noted for its heavy use of brass flower petals and mottled parchment shades. On the kitchen table stood the lamp that was destined to play a subtle and important role in our future. My old man dove back into the box, burrowing through the crackling packing. "Aha! Here's the shade!" A monstrous, barrel-shaped, bulging tube of a shade, a striking lingerie pink in color, topped by a glittering cut crystal orb, was lifted reverently up and put out on the table. Never had shade so beautifully matched base. Within an instant, the old man had screwed it atop the fulsome thigh, and there it stood, a full 4 feet from coquettishly pointed toe to sparkling crystal, his eyes boggled behind his Harold Lloyd glasses. "My God, ain't that great? Wow!" He was almost overcome by art. "What a great lamp!" "Oh, I don't know." My mother was strictly the crochet doily type. "What a great lamp! Wow! This is what we need for the front window! Wow! Holy smokes!" He swept up the plastic trophy, his symbol of superiority, and rushed out through the dining room and into the living room. Placing the lamp squarely in the middle of the library table, he aligned it at exactly the center of the front window. We trailed behind him, applauding and yipping. He was unrolling the cord, down on all fours. "Where's the damn plug?" "Behind the sofa," my mother answered quickly in a vaguely detached tone. "Quick, get out in the kitchen. Get me an extension." This is a description that I'm particularly fond of right here. This is something that is rarely talked about in American homes. Our entire world was strung together with extensions. Outlets in our house were rare and coveted, each one buried under a bakelite mound of 3-way, 7-way, and 10-way plugs and screw sockets, the entire mess caught up in a twisted, snarling Gordian knot of frayed and cracked lamp cords, radio cords, and God knows what. Occasionally, in some houses, a critical point was reached, and one of these electrical bombs went off, sometimes burning down whole blocks of homes, or more often, blowing out the main fuse, plunging half the town into darkness. "Get the extension from off the toaster!" he shouted from under the sofa where he was burrowing through the electrical rat's nest. I rushed out into the kitchen, grabbed the extension, and scurried back to the scene of action. "Give it to me, quick!" His hand reached out from the darkness. For a few moments, full silence, except for clickings and scratching, and deep breathing from behind the sofa. The snap of a few sparks, a quick whiff of ozone, and the lamp blazed forth in unparalleled glory. From ankle to thigh, the translucent flesh radiated a vibrant, sensual, luminous, orange, yellow, pinkish nimbus of pagan fire. All it needed was tom-toms, and maybe a gong or two, and a tenor singing in a high, quavery, earnest voice, "A pretty girl is like a melody." It was alive. "Hey, look!" The old man was reading from the instruction pamphlet that had been attached to the cord. "It's got a two-way switch here. It says, in one position, it's a tasteful night lamp, and in the other, an effective, scientifically designed reading lamp." "Oh, boy, this is great." He reached up under the shade to throw the switch. "Why can't you wait until the kids are in bed?" My mother shoved my kid brother behind her. The shade had a narrow scallop of delicate lace circling its lower regions. "Watch this!" The switch clicked. Instantly, the room was flooded with a wave of pink life that was pure perfume of illumination. "Now that is a real lamp." The old man backed away in admiration. "Hey, wait, I want to see how it looks from the outside." He rushed into the outer darkness, across the front porch and out into the street. From half a block away, he shouted, "Move it to the left! Okay, that's got it! Oh, you ought to see it from out here! Wow!" The entire neighborhood was turned on. It could be seen up and down Cleveland Street, the symbol of victory. The rest of that evening was spent in honest, simple peasant admiration for a thing of such transcendent beauty, very much like the awe and humility that we felt before such things as Christmas trees and used cars with fresh coats of Simon eyes. It was pure beauty. The family went to bed in a restless mood of festive gaiety. That is, everyone except my mother, who somehow failed to vibrate on the same frequency as my father's spectacular additional major award. That night, for the very first time, our home had a nightlight. The living room was bathed through the long, still, silent hours with the soft glow of electric sex. The stage was set. The principal players were now in the wings. The cue was about to be given for the greatest single fight that ever happened in our family. Real-life man and wife, mother and father battles rarely even remotely resemble the theatrical or the fictional version of the struggle between the sexes. You agree with that? Do you agree with that, Studs?
You're talking about Virginia Woolf now.
Yeah. Homes have been racked by strife and dissension because of a basic difference of opinion over where to go on a vacation, what kind of a car to buy, or a toaster that made funny noises, or a sister-in-law's false teeth, not to mention who's going to take out the garbage and why. In all of my experience, I have never known homes that had the kind of fights that appear in plays by Ed Albee or Tennessee Williams. It would never have occurred to my father to bellow dramatically in the living room after 27 scotches, "You're not going to emasculate me!" The old man would not even know what the word emasculate meant, much less figure that that's what my mother was up to. On the other hand, my mother thought emasculation had something to do with the women getting votes. But in any event, sex was rarely argued and fought over in my household, in any household that I ever heard of, outside of heaving novels and nervous plays. That was not the kind of fights we had at home. There was no question of emasculation or role reversal. My mother was a mother. She knew it. My old man, he was the old man. He knew it. There was no problem of identity, just a gigantic clash between two opposing physical presences, the immovable body and the force that is not to be denied. The lamp stood in the middle of the window for months. Every night, my mother would casually, without a word, draw the curtain shut while Bing Crosby sang from the old Gothic Crosley, "Hail KMH, hail to the foe, onward to victory, onward we must go." The theme song of the Kraft Music Hall. The old man would get up out of his chair, casually. He would pull the curtain back, look out, pretending to be examining the weather, and leave it that way. 10 minutes later, my mother would get up out of her chair, casually, saying, "Gee, I feel a draft coming from somewhere." This slowly evolving ballet spun on through the winter months, gathering momentum imperceptibly night after night. Meanwhile, the lamp itself had attracted a considerable personal following among cruising prides of pimply-faced adolescents who night after night would hardly wait for darkness to fall and the soft, sinuous radiation of passion to light up the drab, dark corners of Cleveland Street. The Pop Company, who, by the way, this leg was a symbol of this Pop Company that put on the contest. We didn't mention that. You know that, have you ever seen that that orange drink with the symbol of a lady's leg? You ever heard of knee-high? You know that they have a lady's leg as a symbol? Knee-high? The Pop Company enjoyed sales of mounting intensity, even during the normally slack winter months. Their symbol now stood for far more than a sickeningly sweet orange drink that produced window-rattling burps and cavities in adolescent teeth of such spectacular dimensions as to rival Mammoth Cave. Night after night, kids' eyes glowed in the darkness out on the street before our house like predatory carnivores of the jungle in full cry. Night after night, the lady's leg sent out its silent message. The breaking point came, as all crucial moments in history do, stealthily and on cat's feet, on a day that was notable for its ordinariness. We never know when lightning is about to strike or a cornice to fall. Perhaps it's just as well. On the fateful day, I came home from school and immediately opened the refrigerator, looking for something to eat. Seconds later, I am knocking together a salami sandwich. My old man, it was his day off, is in the john, hollering as he always did, accompanied by the roar of running water, snatches of song, complaints about no pressure, the usual. My mother is somewhere off in the front of the house, dusting, puttering about, dusting. Life is one long song. The White Sox have won a ball game, and it's only spring training. The old man is singing. My brother is under the day bed whimpering. The salami is as sweet as life itself. The first fireflies were beginning to flicker in the cottonwoods. Northern Indiana was at long last emerging from the iron grip of the Midwestern winter. A softness in the air, a quickening of the pulse. Expectations long lying dormant in the blackened rock ice of winter sent out tentative, tender green shoots and yawned toward the smoky sun. Somewhere off in the distance, ball met bat, robin called to robin, and a screen door slammed. In the living room, my mother is talking to the aphids in her fern plant. She fought aphids all of her life. The water roared. I started on a second sandwich, and then... crash! Oh, a phony stifled gasp in the living room. A phony gasp. A split second of silence while the fuse sputtered and ignited. And then it began. The old man knew. He had been fearing it since the very first day. The bathroom door slammed open. He rushed out, dripping, carrying a bar of Life Boy, eyes rolling wildly. What broke? What happened? What broke? The lamp. A soft, phony voice, feigning heartbreak, vibrated with tension for an instant the air. A vast magnetic charge, a static blast of human electricity, made the air sing. My kid brother stopped in mid-whimper. I took the last bite of salami, knowing that this would be my last happy bite of salami forever. The old man rushed toward the dining room. He fell heavily over a footstool, sending a shower of spray and profanity toward the ceiling. Where is it? Where is it? There it was. The shattered kneecap under the coffee table, the cracked, well-turned ankle under the radio, the calf, that voluptuous poem of feminine pulchritude, split open like a rotten watermelon, its entrails of insulated wire hanging out limply over the rug. That lovely lingerie shade stove in had rolled under the library table. Where's my glue? My glue? Oh, my lamp! My mother stood silently for a moment and said, I don't know what happened. I was just dusting and I... The old man leaped up from the floor, his towel gone, in stark nakedness now. He bellowed, You always were jealous of that lamp! Jealous? Of a plastic leg? Her scorn ripped out like a hot knife slicing through soft oleomargarine. He faced her directly. You were jealous because I won! That's ridiculous. Jealous. Jealous of what? That was the ugliest lamp I ever saw. Now it was out. Irretrievably. The old man turned and walked to the window. He looked out silently at the soft, gathering gloom of spring. Suddenly he turned, and in a flat, iron voice, "Get the glue." "We're out of glue," my mother said. My father always was a superb user of profanity, but now he came out with just one word, a real father word, bitter and hard. "Damn it!" Without another word, he stalked into the bedroom, slammed the door, emerged, wearing a sweatshirt, pants and shoes, his straw hat, and out he went. The door of the Oldsmobile slammed shut in the driveway. Crunch! Crash! A tinkle of glass. He had broken the window, the one thing he loved, the car that every day he polished and honed. He slammed it in reverse. Rawr! We heard the fender drag along the side of the garage. He never paused. Roam! He's gone. We are alone. Quietly, my mother started picking up the pieces, something she did all of her life. I am hiding under the porch swing. My kid brother is now down in the coal bin. It seems seconds later. Up the driveway he charged in a shower of cinders and burning rubber. You could always tell the mood of the old man by the way he came up that driveway. Tonight there was no question. A heavy thunder of feet roared up the back steps. The kitchen door slammed. He is carrying 3 cans of glue, iron glue, the kind that garage mechanics use for gaskets and for gluing back together exploded locomotives. His voice is now quiet. "Don't touch it. Don't touch that lamp." He spread a newspaper out on the kitchen floor and carefully, tenderly laid out the shattered, fleshly remains. He is on all fours now, and the work began. Painfully, hopelessly, he tried to glue together the silk stocking, life-size symbol of his great victory. Time and again it looked almost successful, but then when he would move his hand carefully, he'd remove it. Boing! The kneecap kept springing up and sailing across the kitchen. The ankle didn't fit. The glue hardened into black lumps, and the old man was purple with frustration. He tried to fix the leg for about 2 hours, stacking books on it. A Sears Roebuck catalog held the instep, the family Bible pressed down on the thigh, but it was not working. To this day, I can see my father, wearing a straw hat, swearing under his breath, walking around a shattered plastic lady's leg, a Freudian image to make Edward Albee's best efforts pale into insignificance. Finally, he scooped it all up. Without a word, he took it out the back door and into the ash bin. He sat down quietly at the kitchen table. My mother is now back at her lifelong station, hanging over the sink. The sink is making the sink noise, especially in the evening, a kind of sucking, gargling, choking wretch. And then a short, hissing wheeze and silence until the next attack. Sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd lie in my bed and just listen to the sink. And now the old man is sitting at the kitchen table. It was a white kitchen table, enamel with little black chip marks all around the edge. In dead silence, they sat. My old man read his paper. Yes, the battle had moved into the trench warfare, or great freeze stage, and continued for 3 full days. For 3 days, my father spoke not. For 3 days, my mother spoke likewise. There was only the sink to keep us kids company. And, of course, each other, clinging together in the chilly, subterranean, icy air of a great battle. Occasionally, I'd try, "Hey, Ma, you know what Flick's doing?" Her silent back hunched over the sink. Or, "Hey, Dad, Flick says that... What do you want?" 3 long days. Sunday was sunny, and almost like a day in midsummer. Breakfast, usually a holiday thing on Sundays, had gone by in stony silence. So at dinner, my father was sitting in the living room with the sun streaming in, unobstructed through the front window, making a long, flat, golden pattern on the dusty oriental rug. He was reading Andy Gump at the time. My mother, was struggling over a frayed elbow in one of my sweaters. Suddenly, he looked up and said, "You know, here it comes." My mother straightened up and waited. "You know, I like the room this way." There was a long, rich moment. These were the first words spoken in 72 hours. She looked down again at her darning and said in a soft voice, "Yeah, you know, I'm sorry I broke it." "Well," he grew expansive, "that was pretty jazzy. You know." "No," she answered. "I thought it was very pretty." "Nah, it was too pink for this room. We should get some kind of a brass lamp or something for that window." She continued her darning. He looked around for a moment, dropped the funnies noisily to get attention, and then announced in his now for the big surprise voice, "Hey, how about all of us going to a movie? How about it? Let's take in a movie." 10 minutes later, we are in the Oldsmobile, on our way to see Johnny Weissmuller. The drizzle had become a full rain by the time I realized that I was the only one left in the windswept garden of the Museum of Modern Art. Okay?
And so it seems that as this marvelous story is read by Gene Shepherd, we have the beginnings of pop art. But more than that, it's obviously the story. It seems to me an archetypal American tale, though told and with Gene Shepherd's own brand of whimsy and bite and humor. And strangely enough, a word perhaps not associated with Shepherd, he might laugh at his compassion. Well, understanding's the word. Anyway, Gene Shepherd, this is just excerpts from his book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, and Doubleday, the publishers. And it's, I find it a very endearing book, and a very, strange enough, a revealing book, too. And Gene, you have to go. I know we have to scram right now, but let this be one more chapter in our meetings, to meet again. And there are recordings, of course, of Shepherd to be heard on Elektra, perhaps other labels. And he's heard in New York on WOR. And the book itself is what you guess it is, Thoughts of a Particular Midwesterner, Now East, at the same time. You can take the boy out of the Midwest, but there it is.
You know, I get carried away when I start reading some of the stuff, and I hope I didn't bore you at any point.
This happens to be a story unto itself, I think, this particular story. Even though it began with how pop art began. Yeah. It's a funny thing, and the truth is this is probably pop art. That's the point.
Sure.
Pop artists of the day have borrowed. So.
Oh, of course, and all the things which were considered slob art at one time have become the province of Andy Warhol, and they're now hanging in the Modern Museum. My father would have been delighted to see his leg down there with a sign on it that says $2,000. You know.
The book itself, by the way, ends, "The day shift drops by for a belt, and so the story continues a new day, and the guys are coming from the shift at the mills, and life begins so far removed from Manhattan, of which you're part now, Gene Shepherd, and yet it seems the two worlds are yours."
Well, Studs, I just want to thank you for having me by, and I can't tell you how delighted I am that you like the book, because when we get off the air someday, I'll tell you the importance that you have played in my life.
I'd like to hear that.
and it's, it's like coming out to Yankee Stadium one day and swinging at a couple of balls, and Roger Maris walks up and says, "You know, kid, I like the way you swing."
Well, all right, Roger Maris. He shipped the territory, and I am. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Studs.
Gene Shepherd. And so the book is In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, Gene Shepherd, Stories, Remembrances, in the form of a patchwork sort of novel, but stories, each one an entity unto itself. Doubleday, the publishers.